From Quality Radio Productions, it's the Upstate Radio Theater. I'm Jake Longwell. We'll open this hour of old-time radio with an episode of the CBS Radio Workshop. This was a mid-1950s revival of the Columbia Workshop, a series created by Irving Reese in the late 1930s. Reese created the Columbia Workshop so that experimental radio drama would have a space of its own, an area where producers, writers, and actors could perform radio plays which most commercial radio sponsors would be unwilling to try. The CBS Radio Workshop was a very successful revival of this concept in the mid-1950s, with a total of 85 episodes produced in 1956 and 57. This particular episode is about as experimental as one can get, in my opinion, when it comes to radio theater. It's program number 19 in the series, and it was originally broadcast on June 1st of 1956. This episode was not only produced and directed by Anthony Ellis, but Mr. Ellis is one of the lead characters in the episode, the other lead character being William or Bill Conrad, with a supporting cast of other very familiar CBS radio actors and actresses of the mid-50s. As I said, from June 1st of 1956, the CBS Radio Workshop and its presentation of A Matter of Logic.
CBS Radio presents the CBS Radio Workshop, dedicated to man's imagination, the theater of the mind. Tonight, a study in semantics, or a play on words. It is written by Anthony Ellis and is called A Matter of Logic.
All right, Bill, hold it. You mind, Bill? I'd like to get a timing on this thing. We're late now.
Oh, I'm sorry, Tony.
All right, hold it quiet now. We'll start again from the top. Keep it quiet, real quiet. From the top again.
Hey, Tone.
Yes, Bill.
Look, seriously, while you stop, it's none of my business, but you got three titles in there. The show's confusing enough as it is without that. Can't you cut it?
Bill, look, we've got an hour until we go on the air. Now, can we finish the dress rehearsal first? We've spent the whole bloody afternoon going through this.
Okay. I'll keep my mouth shut.
All right, once more, please. You from the top. Keep it quiet. All right, here we go.
CBS Radio presents the CBS Radio Workshop, dedicated to man's imagination, the theater of the mind. Tonight, a study in semantics, or a play on words. It is written by Anthony Ellis and is called A Matter of Logic.
Well, Bill, that's supposed to be a word cue for you.
I'm sorry, Tony. I was just trying to figure it out, that's all.
Figure what out?
Well, how to do this thing, Tony?
Well, don't you think it's a little late for that, Bill? Why don't you just try it all the way through? Maybe it'll come together. You've spent most of the rehearsal arguing about the logic. Now, perhaps if you try a performance...
Oh? Well, if you don't like my performance, Tony, maybe you better get yourself another boy,
huh? I haven't heard a performance yet. Now, come on, Bill, please.
Look, you've given me 26 minutes of monologue to play. That's a lot of double talk, and I don't understand it. Nobody in the studio understands it, and the audience is not going to understand it. But you want me to give a performance, huh?
Wait a minute. I'll come out. We'll get this thing settled once and for all. Cast, you might as well take 5 minutes. I'll be right out.
Where's the coffee?
Hugh?
Yeah?
You know what this is all about? Do you understand it?
Well, don't ask me, Bill. I'm neutral. I just want to get a timing on my closing announcement. We'll probably have cuts, and I don't know what I'm going to do with it.
You want coffee, Will?
Yeah, Stace, would you?
All right.
I know he wants to do a dress, Stace, but what's the use? I don't know what the narrator's talking about half the time, and the other half's a lot of nonsense anyway. I don't know what he wants me to do. As far as I'm concerned, he might just as well fill the time with a half hour of music. I can't do this thing.
Oh, stop it. Sure. How do you want your coffee?
No, black.
Okay.
Been on my back all day long. Well, maybe he knows what he wants, but I don't.
All right. I'd just as soon skip the rehearsal if I can get you to understand the show. Take a chance of getting off the air on time. Cars, will you hold it down, please? Hold it quiet. Now, what's the problem, Bill?
Are you kidding, Tony? I don't understand any part of this thing.
Oh? Well, I don't see why not. Stacy?
Yeah?
Stacy, you want to tell him in a couple of words? Seems to me at this point it shouldn't take much more than that.
No, you just leave me out of it, Father. I've been through this before with you two, remember?
Scotty, you want to call a coffee shop?
I think there's a lot to be said for both sides.
Oh. All right, Polly. Right now, I'd like to do the side that Bill's got to play. You want to tell him?
Well, I see your point,
Well,
Bill,
thank you, Parle.
Well, Tony wrote the script and... Well, he must have known what he had in mind. Didn't you, Tony?
Thanks a lot, Parle. Fred?
Oh, I'm sorry, Tony, I wasn't listening. What page are you on?
Oh, that's all right. It's all right, Fred. Well, Mary Jane, you got any ideas?
Well, I think, look, airwaves are something. You can't see airwaves, but they are something. And the sun rays, you know, the what are those rays? The sun rays? The cosmic rays. Now, they're something. You can't see them.
Well, how about sound? You know, the largest tree in the forest can fall, but unless the disturbed air caused by the crash reaches the eardrum of some living thing, there will be no sound.
Oh, really?
All right, hold it down. This isn't getting us anywhere. Quiet, please,
look,
will you?
Tony, don't worry about them understanding it. I'm the guy who has the problem. I'm the guy saddled with 99 million words. Look, why don't you worry about me understanding? And I don't understand it, and I don't know where to start.
All right, Bill. Let's start at the beginning.
We've been through that.
All right, we'll do it again. Line 17. Hold it quiet, will you please? 17, definition, page one.
It's pointless, Tony.
No. Not if it makes you understand. Line 17. Now, come on, Bill. Let's try.
All right. Nobody. A noun. Meaning no person. No one. Hence, a person of no influence, importance, or social standing. An insignificant person.
Okay, fine. Now, let's stop right there. Now, forget the script for a minute.
I'd be delighted.
Oh, come on, Bill. Now, I'm trying to get this thing done.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
All right, now. Nobody. Meaning no person, no one. Hence, a person of no influence, no importance.
But they're not the same thing, Tony. They're separate and distinct. And besides, that's not what you're saying in the script.
Well, what am I saying?
You're saying nobody, no-body, is really somebody.
That's right. In order for there to be a nobody, there has to be a, or has to have been, a somebody.
It's a play on words then, Tony, but it isn't logic.
But of course it is, Bill.
Oh, no, it isn't.
Now,
wait a minute.
Wait a minute. Look here. Supposing you and Junior at home, telephone rings, and he says...
It's probably for you anyway.
Yeah, honey, I will. Hello. Hello.
Who was it, honey?
I don't know. Nobody's there. They must have hung up.
Oh.
Nobody was there, Bill. Right?
Yeah, that's right, Tony.
But there had to be somebody on the other end to ring your phone.
What's the point?
That particular nobody, the one on the phone, was somebody.
Not when I answered the phone, he wasn't.
Let me finish now. That's one nobody. All right, now here's another one. You're home. It's dinner time. Somebody comes to the door.
Bill, someone's at the door. I'm getting the dog's food ready.
Okay, I'll go. Lisa, honey, will you please be quiet?
Who was it?
Nobody. Probably some kids.
Nobody, Bill. But somebody rang the doorbell. Junie said someone was at the door. Hmm?
I'm not arguing with
you, Tony. Up to now, though, you follow me.
I understand that when I go to the door, there's no body at the door. The absence of a body. Hmm?
Nobody.
All right. Nobody.
And the same thing with nothing. Nothing can also be something.
Well, let's finish with nobody
first. No. They tie up. Now, you don't understand what I'm trying to say in the script, Bill, that nobody is really somebody and nothing is always something. That's the whole idea. They're inseparable. Now, look, let's take nothing.
Go ahead.
You're upstairs. You're in bed. I know you've put the light out, and you're almost asleep, and suddenly Junie turns over and shakes you.
Bill.
Huh. What?
Bill, I heard something downstairs.
What is it?
Wake up. Bill.
What is it?
I heard something.
Where, honey?
Downstairs.
Oh, darling, the dogs would have barked. Now go to sleep.
No, I heard it again just...
Now, there is something, Bill.
Oh, for... Right. Seems to me you're always hearing something.
Well, I did. Listen.
Oh, it's probably a tree branch.
No, it isn't.
I wish you'd wear earplugs.
Be careful.
Of what?
You look all over downstairs, Bill. You don't hear anything. You don't see anything. So you go back upstairs, and Junie says to you...
What was it?
I told you nothing. There's nobody there, nothing at all.
Nothing there. Nobody there. But you both heard a sound.
Well, you say we did. I didn't, Tony. Besides, why have I always got to be the one who answer the phones and the doorbells and get up in the middle of the night? Why don't you let her do it?
Funny. Well, no, let's not be funny. I'm as sick of this thing as you are, Bill.
I doubt that,
We've got
Tony.
A show to put on the air in about 40 minutes, and it's going to go on. Now, will you please try to help?
You haven't said anything new, Tony. I know what you're getting at. You're saying nobody, nothing, are somebody and something. Tangible somebodies and somethings, but they're not, Tony. Now, if you want to make a play on words, that's all right with me, but what you're asking me to do is make reality out of fantasy, and that's the way you want me to play it, but I can't do it, Tony. It can't be done. It's not logic, and we can sit here for 10 hours. That's not going to change
anything.
But
you do agree that nobody is the absence of somebody?
Obviously.
As an example.
Oh, that's not. I don't want any more
examples. As an example, you're a policeman. You get a call about a murder. You go to the scene of the crime, and while you're there,
Excuse me, Mr. Ellis.
Yes, Hugh.
I'd like to be able to run through the closing before we go on the air. There are a couple of things...
It's all right. We'll have time. Now, don't worry about it.
Thank you.
Look, Tony, why don't we just forget about it, huh? I'll do
no,
the best
no, no,
I
no,
can.
No. This may help to straighten it out. Now, look, you're a policeman. You go to the scene of a crime.
Yeah.
When you get there, the officer on the beat's waiting for you.
What happened?
Near as I can find out, there's been a murder, sir. Witnesses report hearing shots and a scream. They're right over there. You want to talk to them?
Where's the body?
Well, that's the funny part about it. There isn't one. No body.
What do you mean, no body? You said a murder's been committed.
Yeah, I know, but when I got here, there was no body anywhere around.
Well, what happened to it?
I don't know, sir. Nobody seems to know.
Now, that's the absence of somebody, some corpse. In other words, no corpse, no body.
Go on.
And the officer says nobody seems to know. Now, that's a different nobody, Bill.
So?
But the nobodies who don't seem to know anything about the missing bodies are the witnesses, right?
Yeah.
And the witnesses are somebodies, but they're also nobodies.
Look, Tony, I'm tired. I'd just as soon drop the whole thing. You're right. You are right. I can do the show, and I will do the show.
And you understand it?
No, I don't understand it, Tony. All you've managed to do is make it even more confusing.
Well, I think we're on the right track. You'll see it in a minute.
Well, I just as soon not.
Well, we've gone this far. Now, let's finish.
None of this has got anything to do with the script I've got to do, though, Tony.
Bill, it's got everything to do with it, if you'll just be open-minded about
it. Look, you're very convincing. If you want 2 and 2 to make 5 for the sake of argument, you can do it with fantasy. You can do anything. I agree with you. 2 and 2 make 5. But it isn't logic, Tony. It's fantasy. That I can play if you want me.
But I don't want you to play it as a fantasy, Bill. I want you to play it as a realistic piece because it is reality.
We're back where we started.
Are you deliberately trying to be arbitrary, Bill?
Oh, come off. Knock it off,
I mean
Tony.
It.
Listen, I'm just an actor. You wrote this epic. You're directing it. Now, if you can make me understand what you want, I'll play it for you. It's not my fault if you're inarticulate.
Or you're so blasted obstinate that you won't see what I'm trying to say.
What? What are you trying to say?
Right,
I wish you'd tell me.
Please.
Look, if I can't understand, how do you expect the audience to, huh? I've got a wonderful idea. Why don't you play this thing yourself, and I'll go sit in your little control room and wave my finger at you. How about that?
If it weren't so late, Bill, I'd try that.
I'll bet you would, yeah. That's a nice piece of arrogance.
Do you mind if we get into personalities after the show, Bill?
I'm sorry, Tony. I'm sorry, fellas.
It's all right. It's all right. It's my fault, too. Now, look, I'm trying to see your side, Bill. I really am. Will you just do one thing for me? Now, maybe this will clear it up.
Yeah, sure. What?
Turn to page 21. 21. Yeah. Line 8. No, I'll start on 10. Yeah, that's it. That great assemblage of nobody's line 10.
I got it. Who are they? That great assembly of nobodies. Where do they come from? But why should I be afraid? They're non-existent. They can't. They don't affect me.
Well?
Well?
Well, that's it, isn't it?
What, Tony? Who are the nobodies? Where did they come from? Will you tell me? I still don't get it.
Bill, by the time you get to that speech, you've already been answering the question for 20 pages, and you can't even see
it.
No,
I can't see it.
Oh, Lord. Hold it, Stacy, will you? Bill, that's the whole point of the show. You, the narrator, tells the audience that nobodies are somebodies. You spend 20 minutes doing it, but the twist at the end is that because you're so logically minded, so analytical, you're not flexible enough to encompass the enormity of the truths you've been saying.
Are you talking about me now or this character I'm
the
playing?
The character.
All right. Now for me, huh? Little old Bill, you tell me. Where do they come from, Tony? I'm as stupid as this character I'm playing. Where do these nobodies come from?
Okay, you said it somewhere back on 10, I don't know, 10, 11, doesn't matter. Look, I'll give it to you simply.
Yeah, you do that. You make it very simple.
Don't worry, I will.
Excuse me, Mr. Ellis.
Yes, Hugh, what?
I'll be able to get that timing on the close, won't I, in case you want some cuts. We've only got 20 minutes.
You'll have time, Hugh, before air. Now, don't worry.
Thank you.
I don't know why I took this call. I could have gone fishing today.
Well, nobody twisted your arm,
Bill. Oh, don't say nobody that way, please.
All right. Now, look. Just keep an open mind and listen.
Okay, open mind and I'm listening.
Nobody's... are really somebodies.
You've said that.
I'm saying it again. All the nobodies we hear about, the nobody on the phone, nobody at the door, all of them, they're somebody. Where do they come from? Well, all right. Let's say you and I go out for lunch, dinner.
Yeah.
We're having a drink. Somebody comes into the restaurant, anyone. You see him, I don't know him, but you do. You lean across the table to me and you say,
"Hey, Tom, look over there.
Hmm?
See that fella coming in with a blonde?
Yeah.
Oh, what a bum. That's the biggest nobody in the business. Let me tell you what he did.
Now, Bill, what did you call him?
I called him a nobody, Tony. I know what you're getting at.
No, you better let me tell you what I'm getting at. It'll save time. All right, now. That nobody that you saw in the restaurant, let's say he died about a year later.
Oh, well, that's too bad.
And what happened to him?
Oh, he became Bridie Murphy, huh?
All right, Bill, now, look.
I'm sorry. Go on.
He died. He died and became one of that great assembly of nobodies.
Uh-huh.
He's one of them. Like all the others, everybody who's ever been called a nobody, after they die, they come back. They're the nobodies who ring doorbells and aren't there when you answer, who ring phones and hang up.
Oh!
Well, now you do understand?
Well, I understand, Tony. That this is a very cute fantasy, Tony, a play on words. All the slobs I've ever called nobodies come back to haunt me, huh? Oh, well, this I understand, and it's very clever, and it's very cute.
And you really understand?
I said I understand.
Good. And do you understand that those nobodies, they don't like being nobodies, they want to be somebodies?
Kind of neurotic ghosts, huh? Oh, well, that makes a lot of sense for a fantasy, Tony.
Yeah, now, that's fine. Now, you've got half of it, Bill. What you call the fantasy, what I call the fantasy of the show, but there's also the logic in the show.
No?
Clear, cold logic, realism, fact. I don't care what you call it, Bill, and I guess this is the thing that's throwing you, the combination of the two.
Must be.
The character you're playing doesn't believe in ghosts, so that nobody who rings the bell has to have substance for you. Therefore, he is somebody.
No, he isn't, Tony. He's the absence of the somebody. If nobody's standing outside my door, somebody isn't standing out there either.
That's right. He was gone when you answered, but he's somebody. He's somewhere around. He has to be.
You know, I got a wonderful idea. Why don't you sell this routine to Abbott and Costello? It's better than who's on first.
That's fine. You're a big help, Bill. Thank you.
All right. Okay.
Hold it.
Look, Tony, we've taken long enough over this. Just tell me how you want me to play it, and let's get the thing over with, huh?
Realistically, Bill, that's all.
Oh. That's all.
You asked me to tell you how I wanted you to play it. I've told you.
You can't combine fantasy and realism,
no,
Tony.
No, you can't, Bill, and I can. I've done it, and there's the script.
All right, then I'm a lousy actor. I'm sorry.
So am I, but that's not getting the show on the air.
Look, let me ask you something. You want me to read this stuff straight, huh? And believable?
That's right.
The fantasy part, too?
Yes, but you make it fantasy, remember, only because you don't want to believe that it's logical, that it's happening. It's your way in the story of running away from reality.
I'm running away from nobody.
Yes,
huh?
You are.
Oh, well, boy, that's pretty scary stuff, that is. Oh, if I don't watch out, all the nobodies will come some dark night and get me, huh? Well, that's real strong stuff. It's raw and true to life and documentary.
You know, Bill, that's not a bad idea. The nobodies all over the world, they don't like people like you. You're a somebody. A big somebody.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ellis.
Mm-hmm. And people like you, somebodies like you, call them nobodies. Make them nobodies. And the poor swine, they try to get even.
Ringing doorbells.
Mm-hmm. But it doesn't really get them even. It's a pretty empty victory. Now, the one with the least influence, importance, the most insignificant nobody of all, he's the one who gets a thought.
We'll make a list. We'll make a list of everybody, anybody who's done this to us, made us what we are, nobodies. We wanted to be somebodies all our lives, and they pushed us down, squashed us. So we'll just make a list.
You mean a list through all the ages?
Oh, no, no, just the dangerous ones, the somebodies living today.
What'll we do with them?
What they've done to us.
Make them nobodies?
Well, why not?
But how? They've tried murder, they always catch somebody for the crime. They don't believe that nobody did it. They don't believe in nobody.
Well, we can make them believe. We'll make all those big, important, influential somebodies like us. But the only difference is, they won't have to be dead first. They'll just disappear right off the face of the earth.
But how can we do it? How can we make them disappear?
Well, we use the same method with them as we do with ourselves when we ring a doorbell or make a noise in a house at night. Dissolution. They'll vanish. Poof.
Do you think it would work? Surely it must have been tried before.
Well, not that I've heard. At least it's worth the effort. And I know who we'll start with.
Who?
An actor. I remember what he used to call me. He thinks he's a big somebody. An actor. His name's William Conrad. Yes, sir, we'll start with William Conrad. And when I'm finished with him, he'll be the greatest nobody, the most worthless non-entity in all of existence throughout time.
You know, I'm getting pretty sick of this, Tony.
What, Bill?
You sitting there making snide remarks about me?
No, nonsense. I'm a writer. I've outlined a fable. It's just an extension of the story we're supposed to be doing in about 10 minutes. Maybe someday I'll make it the sequel.
Not with me, you won't.
Oh, come on. I'm only kidding.
I don't feel like kidding, Tony.
Well, there doesn't seem to be anything else to do. Look, you might as well relax until airtime, Bill. Take it easy. I got to go in and time Hugh's closing. Hugh Douglas.
Ready, Mr. Ellis.
Hey, Tony, wait a minute.
Hold it, Hugh. Yeah. Yes, Bill.
Look, let me get one thing straight, huh? I know it's a little late and we'll probably never agree, but for my own ego as an actor, I'd like to have at least some idea of what I got to do with your script, huh?
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
All right, now, you say this show's logical, forgetting the fantasy, and, well, so help me, for the last time. You say that in reality, in substance, nobody and nothing are absolutely and definitely somebody and something, right?
That's right, that's right. The whole story is built on that premise.
And you believe that, huh?
Yes, you know I believe it.
Now, this isn't a philosophical discussion, huh?
Not as far as I'm concerned.
All right, will you grant me this? If I can prove to you that you're wrong, and, well, I'm not just saying this because I want to be right, but if I can prove to you that you're wrong, will you come over and,
Bill,
on my side of the...
Are we going to do this thing,
Father? All right, now hold it, Quad. Go ahead, Bill. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Look, I'm just trying for the last time to understand this thing, huh? Now, look, if I prove that you're wrong, that you're making a play on words, that it's a matter of semantics, this nobody-somebody business, will you let me play the show for what I think it is, a very nice imaginative piece, but not to be taken for anything else? Not realism, not logic, just pure romantic fantasy.
Bill, dear old Bill, if you can prove that in 5 minutes, you sing the part if you want to. Do anything you want with it. But if not, will you do it my way? Will you try to make it realistic?
Okay, Tom, you got a deal. Who's that behind you, Tony?
Hmm? Where? Nobody. Nobody there.
Ah, there, you see? Nobody there. Nobody there. Am I right?
Yeah.
Did you hear anybody, Tony? Anything behind you before I told you to turn around?
No.
And there wasn't anybody, was it?
No.
You're sure now?
Well, come on. Yes, I'm sure. So what?
Hugh, no. Turn around. Face me, Tony. Hugh, you mind standing behind Tony and making a noise, saying something?
Mr. Ellis, I wish we could time that closing. It's getting awfully close to airtime, you know.
Did you hear him, Tony?
Well, of course I heard him.
Well, turn around.
Oh, come on now,
Bill. Is somebody there? Turn around, Tony, and take a look.
All right. All right, now what does that prove?
Somebody's there, Tony, right now. Hugh Douglas. But a minute ago, when you turned around, nobody was there. Nobody. You see? And that nobody wasn't somebody, now was it?
Hmm.
All right, now, look at this table. Right here. You see anything?
No.
There's nothing on the table, huh? Nothing. No thing. You can't hear it, you can't see it, you can't feel it, because it doesn't exist. Am I right?
He's right.
No, all right. Let's
There's nothing
quiet,
there.
Please, let's have it quiet. All right, go on.
All right, now. What's that, Tony?
Well, you...
It's a quarter, right?
Yes, it's a quarter.
A quarter. Something, huh? You see it, you feel it, you even heard it when I threw it on the table. But the nothing on the table a second ago wasn't something until I threw that quarter down there. Now, was it?
Mr. Ellis, we've only got 3.5 minutes. If you're going to want to make any cuts, I've got to.
All right, Hugh, all right. In a minute. We'll have time now. Don't worry. Let me think a minute, Bill.
Oh, well, go ahead, Tony. We've got all kinds of time.
There's nothing.
You see, Tony, that's what I've been trying to tell you. We got a nice fantasy to play here, but that's all.
Wait a minute. Will you let me think, please?
If you'll just accept the fact that it isn't logic and you'll let me play it as a fantasy, we'll have a good show, Tony. Well, a fair show, anyway. I'd know what to do with the part. I could understand how to play it, Tony.
Bill, I hate to admit it, but you know something?
What?
You're right. It's a play on words.
Well, thank you.
3 minutes.
Oh, come on.
Now it makes sense, huh? You know, it just wouldn't have worked, Tony, the other way. Me trying to play against what you've written, well, that's why I couldn't figure it out.
No, you're right, Bill. You are right, and I'm sorry. I'm sorry, and I've given you a bad time.
Oh, forget it, Tony. I'll admit you had me going for a while. You know, you can be awfully convincing when you want to be. I was beginning to wonder if two and two did make fun.
Well, I'll tell you, I'll buy you a drink after the show. Now, I'll make it 2 drinks.
Okay. Mr. Ellis?
Yes, just a second, Hugh. Look, cast, I'm sorry about that dress rehearsal, but will you just play it as you did on the first and second readings? It was fine, sounded fine. This nonsense of mine won't affect you. Bill knows what to do. My apologies.
Mr. Ellis?
Yes, Hugh.
Hey,
yeah, look, why don't you just make an optional 10-second cut? That ought to do it. And if I need it, I'll give you the signal, all right?
Well, I haven't even seen it.
Hey, Tone, look, there's just one more thing.
Yes, Bill.
Look, you know, at the end of the script where I'm supposed to be afraid of the nobody's coming to get me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think if I cut line 25 that maybe...
What?
Maybe.
Well, what, Bill?
What's that noise?
Well, I don't hear anything.
Listen, Tony, you didn't hear it.
Hmm. No, it's just a ringing in your ears. Nothing.
But it is something.
Now, look, this
What's
is a good
noise?
Cut that Bill suggested. Cast, will you make this cut on page 21? Page 21, 21, line 25, and that's cut, all right?
Yeah. Okay. 2 minutes.
Now, is Bill going to finish the speech, or do I...
What's the matter, MJ? Are you sick? Mary Jane?
Bill.
What?
He's gone.
Well, he's probably just gone up.
No, he was standing there right behind you. I was looking at him, and he just disappeared in front of my eyes.
What are you talking about? Bill? Bill?
Mr. Ellis, I've got to read this through.
Where's Bill?
Tony, he's standing right behind you.
Well, I know. Bill?
Farley, did you see him?
Did anybody see Bill?
I was looking at him. I saw him, and he just wasn't there.
Bill?
Bill!
Where did he go? Hey, Bill.
I've got to do this closing. Will somebody please time the closing?
What's going on out there?
I don't know. Bill Conrad seems to have disappeared or something.
Well, better go ahead anyway. We'll time the closing.
Okay. CBS Radio has presented the CBS Radio Workshop from Hollywood tonight, A Matter of Logic, which was written, produced, and directed by Anthony Ellis. Mr. William Conrad and Mr. Ellis were heard as themselves. Others in our cast were Stacey Harris, Mary Jane Croft, Hugh Douglas, Parley Bear, Fred Mackay, Ben Wright, Robert Chadwick, and Bill James. This is Hugh Douglas, inviting you to join us again next week
when we again present the CBS Radio Workshop.
From June 1st of 1956, the CBS Radio Workshop. Experimental radio theater at its best. An episode entitled A Matter of Logic, program 19 in that series. You are listening to the Upstate Radio Theater. I'm Jake Longwell. Up next, something a bit more serious in nature, as we have an episode of One Out of Seven. This series was produced by ABC in 1946, the programs originating from their San Francisco studios. The series was based on dispatches from reputable news organizations, such as the Associated Press. Each week, the editors of One Out of Seven would string together dispatches with a common theme and present them as radio portraits, if you will. All of the characters portrayed in this series were voiced by Jack Webb. Very often, the One Out of Seven series dealt with extremely controversial issues, at least controversial by 1946 standards. ABC was still a new radio network in 1946, and as such, they dared to take risks such as this. Many of the series' episodes deal with racial prejudice, and this episode is certainly no exception to that rule. In fact, this was the first episode in the series. Originally broadcast February 6, 1946 on ABC, Senator Theodore Bilbo. Jack Webb starring in One Out of Seven.
Ladies and gentlemen, the material and direct quotations included in the following program have been taken from authoritative files and from dispatches filed by the Associated Press and International News Service. We present these statements without editorial comment. We assume no responsibility for their content.
The American Broadcasting Company presents One Out of Seven. Make a day, 7 days make 1 week. And from these past 7 days, the editors here in our San Francisco newsroom have chosen the one story which they have judged most worthy of retelling. This is One Out of Seven.
Theodore Gilmore Bilbo is an honorable man. As a member of the United States Senate, he is looked upon as such by the eyes of the law. Perhaps he is looked upon as such by many or most of his constituents. Though his voice occasionally grate upon the nerves, and his views often confound the innocent, the fact remains, as a member of the Senate of the United States, Theodore Gilmore Bilbo is an honorable man. And we do not intend to prove otherwise. We merely wish to cite a few samples of his handiwork, and perhaps a supplementary side glance or two, just for the sake of contrast. Adjust your dials most carefully, citizens. Herewith presenting Senator Theodore Bilbo, picture number one. Scene. The Chamber of the Mississippi State Legislature. Time, March 23rd, 1944. The Speaker.
The Chair recognizes us distinguished guest, the Honorable Theodore Bilbo, United States Senator from the state of Mississippi. Gentlemen, at this moment, I cannot urge you too strongly to continue the valiant fight to uphold our racial integrity. We must renew our faith and allegiance to the color line. For your information, I have found that certain Negro organizations are determined to secure passage of anti-poll tax measures. It's their first wedge toward the fulfillment of a dastardly equality program which Negro leaders have launched throughout the South and throughout the nation. That equality they must not and will not attain.
After his stirring appeal to the legislature, Senator Bilbo informs a small group of friends in confidential tones.
You know, gentlemen, I found out that a prominent national official asked southern colleges and universities to open their doors to Negroes. You know what I told them? Well, I'll tell you what I told them. I told them, I said, Negroes are never getting into our universities. You Negro-loving Yankees can go straight...
As a member of the Senate of the United States, Theodore Bilbo is an honorable man. And we do not intend to prove otherwise. Here is picture number two. Hello, Senator Bilbo speaking.
Senator, this is Representative Marcantonio of New York speaking.
Yes, yes, what do you want?
Senator, I just got a letter from a lady who lives in my district. It seems that she wrote you that letter about your filibustering against the FEPC. Well, she says she stated her case fairly. And she also says that as a reply, you wrote her one of the dirtiest letters possible.
Well, yes, I think I did.
Well, Senator, she also says you addressed her with the greeting, "My dear Dago." Is that correct?
Of course that's correct. That's what I called her. She's a wop, ain't she?
That lady's Italian, Senator. If that's what you mean. I just thought you'd like to know that the lady has three brothers in the army in Europe. One of them has been killed in action already. You know, if you had a shred of decency in you, you'd apologize for that letter.
I'll never apologize. Why, she's getting off light. Now, listen, she really would have been scorched if I was mad.
Theodore Bilbo is an honorable man. We do not intend to prove otherwise. Here is picture number three. Scene: the chamber of the United States Senate. Time: the 30th of June, 1945. Senator Bilbo is filibustering against passage of the Fair Employment Practices Commission. And during his prolonged dissertation to the gentlemen of the Senate, the following occurs.
The senator from Mississippi may continue. Thank you. Gentlemen, I have been hearing much talk about the supposed bravery of our Negro soldiers. I have it on good authority and from some of the highest ranking generals in our army that our Negro troops overseas are an utter and abysmal failure. They're just no good. And as for giving them a vote, why, they'd only sell their votes to the highest bidder anyway. So why give it to them in the first place?
At the same moment, deep in the jungle of an embattled Pacific island, a Negro soldier pens a note back home to his family. And maybe this work's pretty hard, Margaret, but it's a job that you just have to do. It's been 3 days now, and no sleep. Their bombers are still paying us visits, and it still doesn't look like the war's going to be over soon. But we have to keep on. Just keep on. I know. I just know everything's going to turn out all right. And when we finally get back, the folks will realize what we've done. And I'll bet they look at us differently. You know, for the first time, they'll see that bullets can kill anybody. They'll see, black or white, when blood runs out on the ground,
It's all the same color. That's what the Negro GI thought. But back in the chamber of the United States Senate, Theodore Bilbo thought differently.
I have it on good authority, and from some of the highest ranking generals in our army, that our Negro troops overseas are an utter and abysmal failure.
When Senator Bilbo made that statement, he was standing under the roof of the United States Senate. It is very safe in the United States Senate. A bomb hasn't fallen there for quite some time. You must understand, please. This is merely a portrait, an interesting portrait, of a duly elected representative of the American people. For you see, Theodore Bilbo is an honorable man, and we do not wish or intend to prove otherwise. Here is picture number four. Though the senator has firm convictions on certain subjects, there is seen a mounting tide of sentiment equally firm, equally convinced that the senator errs. On the 10th of August, 1940... Senator Bilbo, it is the opinion of the Committee of Catholics for Human Rights that your conduct toward racial minorities is a chilling deterrent to worldwide belief that America is the symbol of democratic freedom and human rights. In a recent statement to the press, you attacked the Jewish people of the United States on the grounds that their race had damned and crucified Christ. You used this highly metaphysical argument to damn, vilify, besmirch, and otherwise persecute the Jewish people in America to further your own political ends. By lucid contrast, a few days after his attack on the Jews, Senator Bilbo is stricken suddenly with a strange ailment. He is put aboard a train and speeds northward for treatment. And is it not strange that the senator demands to be taken to the Mayo Clinic? Is it not strange when you consider that the Mayo Clinic was founded and operated by the Mayo Brothers, two members of the Jewish race professing the Jewish faith? Obviously, the senator is not loath to take advantage of the skill of the Jewish race. In the end, the senator's critical operation is a success, and in a few weeks he returns to the floor of the Senate with another plan for the American Negroes.
Gentlemen, for the best interests of the nation and all concerned, I believe a colony for American Negroes should be established on the west coast of Africa, bordering the state of Monrovia. Because of the exigencies of the times, any Negro who is race conscious and smart should be ready and more than willing to settle down in such a colony in West Africa.
The very same day in the halls of the Senate, hallowed by the figures of men the likes of Lincoln and Jefferson, Theodore Bilbo, as a representative of the American people, had this to say.
I cannot vote for the appointment of Mrs. Franklin Roosevelt as delegate to the United Nations Organization for the United States. No. She is a woman who has professed friendship for the Negro elements in America. She has no place representing us abroad.
Chair recognizes the senator from Idaho.
Mr. President, I should like to congratulate the senator from Mississippi. He doesn't know it, but he just paid a splendid compliment to Mrs. Roosevelt by voting against her. Mr. President, gentlemen, please, please, I'd like to add one more note. A word of warning to our senator from the South. It isn't going to be long now, Senator, before the people of Mississippi see the light and knock you out of office on that part of your anatomy where your few brains are undoubtedly located.
understand, please. This was merely a portrait. An interesting portrait of a representative of the American people. For, after all, Senator Theodore Gilmore Bilbo is an honorable man. He is looked upon as such by the eyes of the law. He is an honorable man. We did not intend to prove otherwise.
The script for One Out of Seven is written by James Edward Moser. Gil Dowd is the producer, and music by Otto Clare at the Hammond organ. The material used in tonight's program was taken from authoritative files and from dispatches by Associated Press and International News Service. Listen next week, same time, same station, for
One Out of Seven.
This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.
Jack Webb starring in One Out of Seven, a series from 1946 from ABC Radio. We heard the first program in the series from February 6th of that year, Senator Theodore Bilbo. A very fitting role for Mr. Webb, as he was a lifelong advocate for eliminating racial prejudice. You are listening to the Upstate Radio Theater. I'm Jake Longwell. If you want to get in touch, it's qualityradioproductions@gmail.com. And please visit our blog and website, qualityradioproductions.blogspot.com. We'll wrap up the hour with an episode of the syndicated series Strange as It Seems. This series was based on the newspaper column of the same name, authored by John Hicks, telling stories of fantastic people and events throughout history. I don't have a specific date for these syndicated broadcasts. The one program in the series that I do have a date for is dated from September of 1939, so we can assume that this series ran during the late 1930s. This is program number two in the series, The Man Who Ate a Fortune and the Origins of the Star-Spangled Banner.
The Man Who Ate a Fortune. You are in England, in the county of Gloucester, in the 18th century. Within a fine house overlooking the square, a dinner is being served. But first, come into the kitchen.
Hurry up there, Pietro. Dutch Picante will be ruined.
Ach, mein Gott, if you don't watch out, the turkey livers will be too done. Turn the spit there, fool dumbkop.
Poor Enrique. He gets tired of dressing turkey livers all day long.
I've offered to do it for him, but he dare not let me. Mr. Rogerson had him sent all the way from Munich.
And yet it is a good life we lead. I have cooked for His Majesty the King, and even he never laid a such a table. It is a fine thing to cook for an epicure.
Oh, in no time he will have no money.
No money? Why, the Rogerson, he has fortune.
Yeah, and what does he do with it? £100 he pays for the plover's eggs direct from Brittany.
These are olive oils. She'll come only from the trees which grow on a certain hill near Siena. Last month it cost him £500.
Remember the cold winter? He paid £100 for the dish of strawberries on New Year's Day? He's a mad one, the master.
Someday he will eat simple food and be glad to have it.
No, I do not think so. If you cannot have a delicacies, I think someday...
Monsieur le Comte, you are enjoying your dinner?
Yes, Monsieur Rogerson. Will you not try these plover's eggs? They came from your own Brittany.
Ah, extraordinaire. How do you do it, Monsieur Rogerson? While eating, I have been transported from Italy to Spain and now back to France.
I am complimented, Monsieur. You see, I have cooks from every country. Each prepares only one food. My friend Mr. Chambers here, he knows.
By Jove, yes. When we were traveling in Germany, we stopped at an inn in Munich, and there Rogerson had some turkey livers en brochette. From that day, he never rested until that cook was in his kitchen.
But, Monsieur Rogerson, if I may be so bold, do you never tire of this once in a while? Do you not forget delicacies?
Never. When my father died, He left me a fortune to do with as I pleased. Ah, I see. You would like, perhaps, a taste of wild honey. It was brought to me directly from an apiary on the slopes of Mount Hymettus.
Oh.
See, does it not suggest to you the sunlight of Greece, the flavor of the ancient days?
Ah, exquisite.
And when we came back, Monsieur le Comte, Rogerson had with him the favored recipes of every famous inn in Europe.
And in another 2 years, all the favored cooks were in my kitchen also. Monsieur, will you try a little specialty of mine?
Ah, what a delicate fragrance. And what are these?
Sturgeon eggs from the Volga.
Tiens.
I have the fish brought to me alive.
Oh, mais non.
A cook from the Russian Imperial Court has prepared a sauce this evening especially for you.
Mon Dieu, you are incomparable. C'est une chose incroyable. Jamais de la vie, jamais de la vie.
When Mr. Rogerson's father died, he left a fortune of $750,000. In 9 years, Rogerson was penniless. During that time, he counted the minutes between meals. Then, without money to buy the delicacies he craved, he could not face life and committed suicide. Strange as it seems, in 9 years, he had actually eaten a fortune of $750,000. Birth of the Star-Spangled Banner. ...1812. The English have burned Washington. As they advance toward Baltimore, they take many prisoners, among them being a certain Dr. Bean, innocent of any wrongdoing. Quickly, the prisoners are transferred to British warships at anchor off the coast near Fort McHenry. When this news comes to President Madison, he sends a young man under a flag of truce out to the enemy fleet. His rowboat is now approaching the British flagship.
Here we are, sir. Be careful, sir, when you stand up. Hold on tight to the companion ladder.
Oh, yes, thank you. I will. There. I have it now. You'd better not wait. It's dangerous here. Our guns might fire on this ship.
Very well, sir. I row back ashore.
Oh, these steps are steep. These ropes are sharp.
Good afternoon, sir.
Oh, I'm Francis Scott Key, under flag of truce with a message from President Madison to Admiral Cockburn.
Very good, sir. Please come with me to the quarterdeck. Up this ladder, please.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Officer of the deck presents his compliments to Admiral Cockburn. An enemy messenger, Mr. Key, is here under flag of truce to see the Admiral.
Just a moment, sir. Admiral Cockburn, sir, an enemy messenger under flag of truce. You may come in, sir.
I'm Admiral Cockburn.
I am Francis Scott Key. President Madison requests the release of Dr. Beans. Dr. Beans is in no way connected with government business, sir.
Beans, let me see. Oh, yes. I cannot give you an immediate answer, Mr. Key. Won't you sit down? You see, there are several items connected with this matter that we... Take care of this prisoner. My place is on deck.
Mr. Key, you come with me, sir. I regret I must place you in this inner cabin for the present, sir.
All night the firing continues, while Francis Scott Key is alone in his cabin, wondering what side will have the final victory. At last, dawn breaks, gray and forbidding over the water. In the distance, Key can see the outline of Fort McHenry. He strains his eyes to discover who now holds the fortress.
Say, can you see? By the dawn's early... If it were only a little lighter I could see. Well, thank God, a rocket over Fort McHenry. Our flag is still flying. Our flag is still there. That's it.
That's it. Our flag is still there. And the rocket's red glare gave proof through the night that our flag was still there.
1814. In Baltimore, a family has finished its supper, and Eliza has settled down to read the Baltimore Patriot.
Mamie?
Yes, Eliza?
Here's a new song. Listen.
That has quite a swing to it.
I tell you, let's play it on the piano. I'll wager that Ned and Father will be right in here.
All right.
Here, I'll fold it so it won't fall over. Now.
Through the dawn's early light, what so proudly we hailed.
Hey, what's all this?
I thought this would bring you. It's a new piece of music called the Star Spangled Banner.
Oh, well, that's very good. Excellent. Who wrote it?
Francis Scott Key.
Really? Why, I used to know him. Well, well.
What's this?
Oh, come on in, Dad. It's a new piece of music.
Stuff and nonsense. I've heard that tune for 40 years.
What?
But, Father, it's just been printed. The music is by James Stafford Smith.
Again, I say nonsense. That's an old drinking song, and I don't approve of young girls singing it.
A drinking song?
Well, yes, of course it is. I've sung that song with friends in London over many a tankard of ale. This Smith is trying to play a hoax. You just listen to me.
To an acorn in heaven, where he sat in full glee, a few sons of harmony sent a petition that he then in la-da-dee-dum-dee-dee.
Now then, do I speak the truth or do I not?
Whether it's a drinking song or whether it's a marching song, I don't know, Father dear. But I don't think you're a very good singer.
What's that? What's that?
This tune was first of all a stately old song of France. Then it was brought to England and turned into a drinking song to honor a famous Greek poet named Anacreon. It was he who originated the phrase wine, women, and song. 20 years later, James Stafford Smith lifted the tune bodily and said that he had written the music to Francis Scott Key's words. Strange as it seems, the Star Spangled Banner, the official anthem of the United States, was a French tune sung in an English tavern to honor a Greek poet.
Strange as it seems, with The Man Who Ate a Fortune and The Origins of the Star-Spangled Banner, that broadcast from the late 1930s. That does it for this hour of Classic Radio. I'm Jake Longwell. Thank you for joining me. Tune in again when you can for more sounds from the Golden Age of Radio. The Upstate Radio Theater is distributed by Quality Radio Productions.